installation art by her mentor, Saul Berenson, Mandy Patinkin, when she is yanked off her project. Seeing the camera pull back on this decorated corkboard is like watching a world come to light. Carrie's 10-year search for the Al-Qaeda terrorist Abu Nazir takes her directly toward a recently rescued Marine sergeant, a handsome redhead named Nicholas Brody, Damian Lewis, who was a prisoner of war in Afghanistan. Carrie suspects that his long stint as a prisoner means he was turned by Nazir and has come back home to wreak havoc on his own soil. Her colleagues, at least in the first season, are not buying it. Except for Saul Berenson, who is more persuadable, since he knows that Carrie is exceptional at what she does. Patinkin's performance is superb, but he does not hide his Broadway roots. A simple knock on Carrie's door has more than a little ragtime in it. Each carefully pitched syllable he utters is pegged to a note, and as his voice climbs and moves emotionally, he sometimes seems to be singing. When Saul says to Carrie, "You're the smartest and the dumbest fucking person I've ever known," he delivers this potentially throwaway line with such concentration, restraint, and theatricality that it becomes the most dramatic utterance thus far in the entire series. Also exceptional is Damian Lewis as Brody, at least in the first season. As the homecoming Marine, he adroitly portrays the military veteran's vexed re-entry to America, not just with trembling and vomiting, but with nuanced glance and grit, even as his every move is being monitored by the CIA. In one of the show's perverse switchbacks, early on, Carrie watches the surveillance footage of Brody and his wife in their bedroom, and by the second season is herself in bed with Brody, and a subject of the surveillance that her colleagues observe in mortified fashion. Entering the footage she was once just monitoring is part of a motif of pornographic fantasy that haphazardly peppers the script. One of Carrie's CIA assets, a sex worker from Sandusky, Ohio, arranges lovers for a Saudi prince. In another story thread, Brody is asked to kill someone he believes he has already killed. Enactments and reenactments abound. When Brody walks through the bright plastic aisles of an American hardware store, the viewer can share his experience of the shop's gaudy abundance. He is looking for a doormat that might work as a prayer rug. He has converted to Islam, a fact he must keep hidden from everyone he knows. He has become a public relations pawn. The military brass would like him to play the hero card and redeploy. The White House would like him to play the hero card and run for Congress. Abu Nazir would like him to play the hero card and put on a suicide vest to take revenge for the U.S. military drone program that has killed Afghan citizens. Brody's return to his home is juxtaposed with flashbacks to the physical and psychological torture and the emotional manipulations he endured at the hands of Nazir. Here, Homeland's editors and camera crew do some of their best work. We see Brody forced, brutally, to assault his friend and fellow Marine Tom Walker, and to dig his own grave. These heartbreaking scenes are some of the most devastating in the entire show. Even upon multiple viewings, when you have new information that allows for a reinterpretation of events, the scenes retain their awful power. The intercut flashbacks also efficiently reveal Brody's life through the years as the tutor of Nazir's young son, who is then killed in a drone attack. This attack is the event out of which almost everything we watch is born. And to this extent, Homeland can be viewed as a criticism not just of cyclical revenge in general, but of the American drone program in particular. Mandy Patinkin, who feels the show is strongly pacifist, has even been on talk shows discussing the even-handed politics of Homeland scripts. In Homeland's second season, the editors are so overloaded with plot threads and have to make such quick cuts that there are several inadvertently funny U-turns and the narrative becomes perilously head-spinning and surreal. But in season one's opening episodes, all is well, and the series' debt to its model, the Israeli television program Prisoners of War, is presumably expressed, though that program is otherwise unavailable in the United States. Watching Brody through the eyes of his daughter Dana, brilliantly played by Morgan Saylor, can also be interesting. Despite his 8-year absence, this teenage girl is Brody's true soulmate, much more so than his bombshell of a wife, who seems always to be stuck with lines like, "I don't understand. What is happening?" Dana is the person who stands next to him in the first yellow ribbon press photo. She is the one he puts his arm around. She is the one who first sees him praying and understands it. Her intuitive knowledge of her dad becomes important in unraveling certain pieces of information, especially in the extremely jammed season 2 finale, which concludes the way a giant fireworks show concludes, with everyone dazed and caught in traffic. In this finale, two American characters played so perfectly by British actors whose accents never slip, Damian Lewis as Brody and David Harewood as David Estes, the CIA counterterrorism director, are zapped from the narrative, one to a mysterious freighter in international waters, and one to the afterlife, as if the actors' visas had expired. The carnage is preposterous, and getting the show back on more convincing psychological territory will be the task of season 3. This is where the daughter will have to be relied on, as she is perhaps the only person in her father's several worlds who has surmised who he is in all of them, and so she is a repository of viewer confidence. She will certainly remain one, at the very least as a kind of psychic and interpreter. It's satisfying to see her brought forward in the storylines, even if her younger brother is getting ominously left behind, and one feels a serious actress's career is in the making. The main problem with Homeland is not even the writers taking Adderall or whatever they did in the second season that eliminated suspense and brought instead an unhinged intensity of movement that barely allowed space and time enough for the cast members to occupy their roles. The main problem with the show is a kind of elephant in the room. Written into several important plot points is the love Brody and Carrie have for each other. For this love, she will hide him from the authorities. For this love, he will kill the vice president, although he is also doing this somewhat for his daughter's spurned sense of justice and for the drone-killed son of Nazir. There is a convergence and confusion of motives in this terrific murder scene, which is done through distanced technology involving a pacemaker, an echo of the drone strike for which the vice president is responsible. The problem with the Brody-Carrie love is that it is unconvincing, and it is unconvincing for many reasons having to do with common sense, but that is not all. Awkward and unlikely love can be trumped by genuine sparks, but viewers will sense a lack of chemistry between Lewis and Danes, two otherwise gifted performers. Perhaps the editing is too abrupt. One minute there is shouting and despair, the next there is smiling in a cozy cottage. Good on-screen chemistry can win out, but these actors project only a cold, canned heat. Is this because their characters are damaged goods? Too jangled inside and too full of apprehension to create the trust and stillness that romance requires, qualities Brody's friend Mike has in spades, especially around Brody's wife? When Lewis goes to touch Dane's face, we fear he may strangle her. When Dane smiles at him, it looks effortful, mere flirtation or perhaps even nervousness. When Brody says to her in their final scene, "You gave it up to me," and Carrie adds, "completely," few viewers will agree. Almost every character in this show has been a double agent of some sort, but especially Carrie and Brody. Yet a double agent may also have a purity of purpose that operating solo allows. You can pick and choose who is worthy of hate and who is worthy of help. A double agent can crawl out of the ideological teamwork and love the forbidden, which both Carrie and Brody have done. A double agent can determine independently who is a bad guy, as does Special Ops Agent Quinn, looking very IRA and defying his orders to assassinate Brody, since every belief system has some. But shared torment is not enough for love between spies. Quinn, too, seems to believe in this Carrie Brody love, but only when viewing it through a sniper's scope. All of Homeland's characters are soldiers and soldierly, but they are also players in a game where the cards are thrown down ever more quickly, and no one really has your back. Friendly fire can occur at any moment. This is too tense-making for what purports to be a love story. Moreover, is Madness times two ever sexy? It is perhaps useful to compare these Homeland lovers with those in the current David O. Russell film, Silver Linings Playbook, where Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper generate quite a bit of sparkle despite both their characters being mentally ill. Of course, Silver Linings is a comedy and has dancing in it, a surefire cinematic express train to romantic love. Cooper and Lawrence may snarl and shout, but they still seem like attractive screwballs in their own sexually charged tale, which just happens to be a screwball comedy. Give Danes and Lewis a country cabin, a roaring fire, and a bottle of wine, and we feel only anxiety. The confessing of life secrets seems therapeutic and expository rather than intimate, and Carrie's irritated, "You interrupted me," startles before the hearth. Creepy cello music in the background does nothing to assist. Perhaps their conversation has too much storytelling to do. It is almost always propelling the plot along, and the sideways moves of courtly dilly-dally and pillow talk can find little opportunity or conviction. One of the final dialogues between Carrie and Brody includes this exchange about Nazir.
"He played us all from the beginning."
"How? By letting himself get killed?"
"Why not?"
"Because it's insane." Insane indeed. In the bonus feature that follows on the box set, the producer, Alex Ganza, refers to them as star-crossed lovers in the grip of a powerful love. But this is not true. They lack mutual trust or any palpable erotic vibe. They are not bonded, and they part without any persuasive anguish. Or rather, they briefly cling, then separate, their anguish only sketchily enacted. There won't be a damp eye in the house. Carrie and Brody's love is in a film noir, while they themselves are in a television series. But Brody has been sent off to Canada so that the writers can figure out what to do next. All is in a state of disconclusion, and season three awaits. Carrie will return to her true partner, her closest colleague Saul, who, as he recites the Kaddish before a roomful of corpses, has the look of new ambiguity to him. Even though he cannot pass a single polygraph test, he has become the acting head of the CIA. As was said to many Americans after September 11th, "You are all in Israel now." Or maybe not. Presumably the show will continue to take received ideas and transform them. It may still fall short of art, but stay tuned. It is likely to continue to shatter viewers' expectations and then glue them back together again, half-cracked. 2013. Jane Campion's Top of the Lake. Jane Campion's police procedural Top of the Lake, a miniseries that aired this spring on Sundance Channel and is now available on Netflix, has the look of transcendence and the theme of sexual post-apocalypse. The catastrophe that is men and the different catastrophe that is women are foregrounded against the romantic, sublime, breathtaking, and perhaps occasionally computer-enhanced locations in New Zealand, shot unmockingly by the Australian cinematographer Adam Arkapaw, who also shot the crime drama Animal Kingdom. The landscape gives Campion's tragic ironies and bone-dry comedy a little something spiritual upstage, like a humming chorus. Part Deliverance, part Road Warrior, part Winter's Bone, part Hobbit, as well as part Old Testament and part New. Top of the Lake creates, in spite of its self-aware collaging, something quite original in this harsh, lush South Pacific. For Americans unfamiliar with this fantastical backdrop, it may, in its initial minutes, seem to be Japan or British Columbia,
with high mountains plummeting dizzyingly to water. It is hard at first to tell where this is. One is reminded of Ava Gardner's, probably apocryphal, comment on arriving in Melbourne to film On the Beach. "I'm here to make a film about the end of the world," she is said to have told the press as she glanced around, "and this seems to be exactly the right place for it." Although much of the patchworked story occurs in a small town where the Southern Lakes Police have a station and desks and look at files and interrogate witnesses in an aggressive fashion, Campion is interested primarily in two adjacent communities, one of women and one of men, both of which have gone off the grid. These communities consist of refuseniks of the libertarian and sexual variety, staked out against modernity, supporting their lifestyles with illegal activities, in the case of the men, and divorce settlements, in the case of the women. Using a dozen or so shipping containers, a string of outdoor lights, and a generator, the women have set up a desert sanctuary on a plot of land called, thank you Toni Morrison, Paradise. There are massages, meditation and hairstyling sessions, support discussions, and naked Gauguin-style swimming, plus a pseudo-guru named GJ, played with crisp enigmatic derision by Holly Hunter. Under GJ's guidance, the group's consciousness is not so much raised as smacked around. She believes in biology as the primary teacher of her flock. "Just go with the body," she goads them, letting it be known that she despises their minds. The women who have followed GJ here are recovering addicts of various kinds. They include Bunny, who pays men to have 7 minutes worth of sex with her, and Anita from Syracuse, New York, who was getting over the grief of having had to euthanize her best friend, a violent and possessive chimpanzee. GJ is a figure of mysterious magnetism and caprice. She has picked the settlement's location totally at random, closing her eyes and putting her finger on a map. Campion does not overuse her, which makes her every appearance in the series riveting. The men, on the other hand, are the local lugs, sometimes seen in the dartboard-decorated pub. The younger ones occasionally communicate in animal sounds. They are largely the motherless sons of the area's de facto patriarch, a drug dealer named Matt Mitchum, who, as a major landowner, controls the area's law enforcement and seems to have sired half the town's population. The threat of incest lies everywhere in Campion's storyline. The mesmerizing Scottish actor Peter Mulan plays Mitchum as a bellicose, aging hippie gun-nut anarchist, one with an inexplicable brogue. Like all great villains, he controls the series as he controls the community, with charisma and bullying. That he is rough-and-tumble handsome makes the viewer's response to him all the more uneasy. One may find oneself hoping that a good-looking man depicted washing a dish or two, as he is, won't turn out to be completely evil. Mitchum also regularly flogs himself with a belt, stripped to the waist and on his knees before his mother's gravestone. He holds the series together through sheer force of personality, and the moment he appears by surprise mid-lake from below the deck of a large motorboat is one of the most hair-raising scream moments since Jessica Walter emerged from the next room as the new apartment mate in Clint Eastwood's Play Misty for Me. When Mulan as Mitchum is absent, Campion's world grows safer, less full of dread, and less interesting. Even in the final episode of the series, when his ostensible cremains are placed triumphantly on a tabletop, they possess the feeling of a genie in a bottle. Elizabeth Moss does serviceable work as the dewy-skinned detective Robin Griffin, who comes to town to visit her dying mother and escape a fiancé about whom she is ambivalent. Like the other women, she is there for a bit of a think, as she puts it to Al, a local police sergeant, on one of their several dates. But soon she is investigating the disappearance of a pregnant 12-year-old named Tui, who happens to be, what else, the daughter of Matt Mitchum. When asked who the father of her baby is, Tui writes on a scrap of paper, "No one." Tui's confusion as to how she became pregnant is less diffidence or ignorance or a virgin birth illusion than a real clue to solving the case. Alas, it is continually misinterpreted. As in most police procedurals, each step forward by the detective is at a diagonal, so each hunch is at once astute, revealing, and slightly inaccurate. Because the path to answers is zigzagging and in constant need of correction, and because Campion has 7 episodes to fill, there is room for detour. Sexually violent backstories are ignited. Griffin, we discover, was gang-raped at a high school prom and subsequently had a child of her own. New characters come to town, and earlier ones disappear. Blind alleys are run up with or without canine assistance. A face-concealing blue hoodie becomes the most plot-pointed hoodie since the red one used to terrifying effect in Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now. Like Roeg's Venice, Campion's town is an insular maze with plenty of secrets, as well as a built-in idea that no one is really watching. Many of its residents, however, have fled, or have tried, or would like to. But if one has a legal conviction, like Robin's ambiguous love interest and former prom date, Jono, also Mitch's son, one cannot even escape to Australia, which of course long ago was once solely for convicts. The sense of nowhere to go is accentuated by the encasement of mountains. If one cannot flee, however, there are places to hide in the surrounding bush, tents to pitch and birdsong to learn, as a summons for food and allies, as in The Hunger Games, another tale of corruption and exploitation in the literal and moral wilderness. Not for nothing is short-haired, blue-eyed Elizabeth Moss, made to look a lot like Kyle MacLachlan of David Lynch's anti-Brigadoon, Twin Peaks. Campion alludes to Lynch not just via Moss or the many cinematic peaks, but most explicitly in a scene where Moss pulls over a vanload of women and asks where they are going. Book club, they lie. Oh, what you reading? She asks. There is silence, then someone says, Blue Velvet. Moss persists. Didn't know it was a book. Who wrote it? A woman growls, We don't care. It is the funniest homage in the series, and because Campion herself wrote the novelization of her 1993 film The Piano, the humor goes in several directions at once. The scene may also express some tossed-off cynicism about contemporary readers and the sororal dependence on language activities. For the series's societal dropouts, words are seldom useful or true. The survivalist tactics of listening closely to one's body and not talking too much are always paramount. The result is an oddly quiet production. Even GJ, the gnomic pronouncer of the body's superiority to the mind, Disillusionment. Get that and get it good, she advises. Stop your helping. Grows tired of the streaming thoughts of the crazy bitches she has attracted, and by the end diverts herself with curt inquiries to an assistant about the best air routes to Reykjavik and the current price of gold. One is reminded of a line Hunter delivered playing a producer in broadcast news. Told that it must be nice to feel you're the smartest person in the room, she replies, No, it's awful. Those who have seen The Piano, another tale of New Zealand, may feel clued in to Campion's directorial coding. Tattoos suggest a nurturing man, and conventional appearances, societal authority, and middle-class righteousness are likely to obscure sadism. The men whom Griffin and her mother love are prominently tattooed. New Age keyboard arpeggios signify a transient meditative state, and speech, its misuses and deformations, its futility and taint, is an object of deep suspicion. This despite Campion's wonderful film Bright Star about the poet John Keats. Although poetry, too, it might be argued, is about verbal inadequacy, the ineffable as it struggles into analog. Perhaps Campion's skepticism about language is one of the reasons she has thrown in so many incongruous accents. Holly Hunter played a mute in the piano. Her voiceover was in an invented accent heard only by the audience. When Elizabeth Moss's accent wobbles, her character is said to have been living in Sydney. When GJ speaks in Holly Hunter's tight-lipped Georgian sibilance, she is said to be a Swiss national. Though hilarious, this explanation is uttered deadpan and received matter-of-factly, as if this far corner of the earth were routinely visited by such global runaways. Matt Mitchum's Scottish trill-gargle bray goes unremarked completely. This eclecticism of vocal style has been used by others in Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven. Though Linda Manns was playing a girl from Chicago, her Brooklyn-accented voiceover never threw the viewer out of the film for a minute. That what she was saying often contradicted what was on the screen only increased the narrative richness. And no man from Wisconsin ever spoke as Daniel Day-Lewis did in Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood. But Campion clearly believes that certain mistakes, rather than remove us from the story, pull us further into its power. Irrealism can add not only to the dream logic, the moviness of the movie, but also to its convincing magic, since such incongruities are often part of life. The confusing signals, the impurity of the signal, gives you verisimilitude, Donald Bartlemy once said. The most haunting and heartbreaking parts of Top of the Lake have to do with mothers and sons. This is the relationship Campion's story most believes in. What few examples she offers of such relationships are suffused with the deep devotion, hope, and remorse that constitute love. One mother-son bond involves the drug-addicted Simone, terrifically acted by Mira Folks, and her bone-collecting semi-mute son Jamie, played by Luke Buchanan, also a friend of Tui's. Jamie is employed by the local coffee shop, where at-risk kids are put to work as baristas. At first, the clean and orderly cafe seems familiar and neutral. Adult characters repeatedly assemble there to drink coffee and discuss Tui's case. But slowly, the shop, modeled on a Danish initiative to assist troubled teens, becomes a character with its own unspoken lines. Its walls, lined with photos of the local children, begin to stare back at our detective, much like her own working wall of suspects' photos. It all casts a freckled light on the idea that it takes a village to raise a child, suggesting that a village may widen the possibility of things going wrong. One hears the echo of GJ's "Stop Your Helping." In Seeking Answers, Campion's tale finally has few places to turn. One may think back on Wild Kingdom, if not Animal Kingdom, and on the suspense of animal appetites. Will the submerged crocodile eat its mate right there in the water, or graze on the tender gazelles on shore? The natural world at the top of the lake is all emerald moss and sexy fog, but humans, as they always do, add drugs and guns and money and violence. Top of the Lake is not especially didactic, despite criticisms that Campion is programmatic and thus predictable in her take on dangerous men and wounded women. And despite the strictures of a medium that demands intermittent commercial breaks and a piled-up finale, and despite story questions that might easily be answered by DNA tests, but are instead scuttled by quick cremations, Top of the Lake is a complex and spooky work of art. Campion uses her storytelling tools loosely but laceratingly. Cold steam rises from the plot holes. She, her cast, and her crew give felt life to the world's vast variety of creature and tone, fashioning an experience no viewer could have possibly dreamed up alone. This is what television at its collaborative best is supposed to do. 2013. Blue is the warmest color. Can a moviegoer set academic theory aside and still ask, what is the cinematic male gaze, and is it so very different from the female one? Is the camera inherently masculine? A powerful instrument of anxiety and lust, forever casting women as objects. The phallic pen has never once deterred a woman writer. And when is a gaze not a gaze but something else, something prurient or false or constructed as if through a rifle sight, or, as one filmmaker friend of mine has said, as something to be viewed in the safety of a dark theater? Moreover, is gazing, with its fraught exile and exiling, what a camera should be doing anyway? Shouldn't the camera instead be trying to get past the gazeness of its gaze, that is, the condition of exclusion, and engage with the observed, knitting together an alliance between viewer and viewed? Is looking necessarily a form of desire, of covetousness or envy? Was not the ultimate male gazer Hans Christian Andersen's Poor Little Match Girl? These are questions inadvertently raised by Abdellatif Kechiche's recent Palme d'Or-winning film, La Vida d'Elle, nuttily translated into Blue is the Warmest Color for Anglophone audiences. In partial explanation, the graphic novel the film is somewhat based on is called, in French, Blue is a Warm Color. The film is not blue in the emotional or pornographic sense. Nonetheless, its brilliant star, Adele Exarchopoulos, portraying a girl also named Adele, suggesting co-authorship of the character, also Arabic for justice, and we do see her in one political march, plays her throughout in a fluctuating state of low-level depression, and the movie's protracted sex scenes, which feature two young athletic actresses, Exarchopoulos and Léa Seydoux, with perfect bodies. When their characters visit an art museum to look at the nudes, it presents an opportunity to glimpse, albeit in marble and oil, some actual figure flaws, have proven a source of controversy, wherein critics have both employed the terms pornography and male gaze, Salon et al., and deliberately avoided them, Manola Dargis et al. The film has already been banned in one Idaho theater, a fun fact that is getting a lot of press. Largely, what is wrong with Kechiche's over-directed ecstatic sex scenes is artistic. They go on too long and are emotionally uninformative, almost comedically ungainly and dull to watch, as most long sex scenes are. Did we learn nothing from Vivien Leigh's little morning after smile and Gone with the Wind? There are more elegant and succinct ways of communicating coital satiety than perspiring and exhausted flesh. These scenes in Blue is the Warmest Color constitute an almost fatal narrative mistake. Cinematic sex, unlike pillow talk, and that includes the pillow talk here as well as that of Rock Hudson and Doris Day, is not all that fascinating because it is not all that shareable. What is being experienced by the characters is not something that can be felt by viewing. But the other problem is that despite these young women appearing expert in what they are doing in bed, the sex may be inauthentic. No youthful fumbling here. Manola Dargis has written in the New York Times that their pantomiming is obvious. Others have noted that Kechiche's lesbian sex is laughably constructed with pornographic tropes. Julie Moreau, the author of the book the film is based on, has also complained of the bedroom choreography. For a filmmaker whose strength seems to be a vital naturalism, these are sticking criticisms. From a narrative perspective, the most perplexing problem with these sex scenes is that they mute and obscure the actresses, who otherwise, in many other parts of the film, offer their intelligent faces and voices to the screen in subtle and moving ways. In visual media, the body is often deeply inexpressive compared to the heart's great canvas, the face. The sex between these characters, as is true of most carnality, causes the interesting parts of these women's personalities to recede. The actresses for long stretches of time become action heroes, and the portrait of them that the film has ostensibly been working on grinds, so to speak, to a halt. One can see then that the movie is doing a lot of narrative wheel spinning at these young women's expense. The director has not arranged for a story with surprises or ideas or momentum or much structure at all, and so, well, he is stalling. He has become one of the ball-busting directors that an actor character at the film's end tells Adele his reason for having quit the movies and gone into real estate. The film begins with 15-year-old Adele going to school, looking quite young in her knit cap. She is viewed from the top of a hill with the attractive city of Lille spread out below, and we watch her, camera at her back, as she descends. Will the entire film suggest that the leaving behind of home and childhood is a descent? Possibly. At her high school, she loves literature. The first classroom discussion is about love at first sight in Marivaux's The Life of Marianne. So the movie introduces the idea of the powerful gaze right at the get-go. Another teacher discusses Antigone, explicating the lines between childhood and adulthood, at least for Greek girls. Although Adele has one great pal, a gay boy, the schoolyard is a slightly vicious place with much sexual gossip and social speculation, and at home Adele has dinner, always spaghetti, with her parents, the three of them watching television while they eat. In general, Adele's soft, wide mouth hangs open throughout the film, revealing an attractive overbite too long associated with French actresses. She pulls her hair up, lets it fall again, ties it back up, continually. Between the slack mouth and the unstable hair, we see quickly that Adele does not quite know who she is. But she is a creature of appetites, and much time is spent watching her pliable mouth chew, pasta, candy, oysters. Director Kechiche, whose 2007 portrait of female resourcefulness, The Secret of the Grain, revolves around a couscouserie, gives us lots of footage of eating, as if in a gastronomic non-witticism, he sees love, especially love between women, as one big restaurant. We see Adele dancing in various settings, her dancing is something of a motif, but uncertainty is written all over her face, even when her arms are raised over her head. We see youth's beauty, but rarely its exuberance. When we first meet the older, more confident Emma, Seydou, she's in a romantic headlock with another girl, but turns surreptitiously to size up Adele. It is a purposeful, appraising leer, and although the audience will recognize it as lecherous and see Emma instantly for what she is, a player, Adele is smitten, like a character in one of the novels she reads. One may momentarily worry about the windy circle of hell reserved by Dante for Francesca da Rimini, reader of love books, and in fact, winds do blow Adele's hair around throughout the film. Adele and Emma meet again in a bar where Emma almost picks Adele up, or at least discourages others from doing so. Emma recognizes Adele as confused and underage, but soon is trolling the edge of the schoolyard to fetch her. She courts Adele with confidence and kindness. Though she looks quite young herself, Emma is meant to be older and more sophisticated, an ambitious artist, and the radiant Seydou does well in communicating the psychological edge Emma has on Adele. The movie then travels through a few years of their love affair together, and we see that Emma, who at first seems comfortable with Adele as her housekeeper and muse, will soon find her too mundane, not glamorous or ambitious enough for her artist friends. When Emma encourages Adele to become a writer, it seems meretricious and self-serving on Emma's part. Adele doesn't want to become a writer and is not much interested in the grad school-style discourse that is supposed to pass as intellectual. Klimt is decorative. No, he's not. Yes, he is. Yes, he is. All is meant to suggest that Adele is running with a headier crowd than the one from her high school days, and as someone who loves her job as an elementary school teacher, she may always be an outsider in Emma's world. There is a reason adults are requested to stay romantically away from teenagers. A minor is more easily overwhelmed, damaged, seduced, hurt. There is a power differential, which can be compounded by class differentials as well. that the film is one big illustration of this should not escape our notice. Can one talk about adult sex with minors if it's a European film? One should hope so, and clearly the film is somewhat aware of this problem, since like Mariel Hemingway's character in Woody Allen's great but troubling Manhattan, during the course of the movie, Adele turns 18. A birthday cake is lit and candles are blown out. Phew, everyone is internationally legal now. But damage of some kind, even if it's the damage of love, has been done. Instead of being outgrown, Adele's vulnerability seems to have seeped in and overtaken her permanently. Romantic love has subtracted from her life rather than added to it, and she seems shatteringly alone. One may be reminded of the tragic Marie in The Dream Life of Angels, 1998, also set in Lille, or of Isabelle Huppert as Beatrice in The Lacemaker, 1977, two French films that take the social class differential of lovers head-on. Beatrice's imaginary Greek windmills are analogous to Adele's 18th-century romances, and although Adele is not likely to crack and break completely, she will be bent in difficult winds. The chances of her thriving do not look promising at all. Girl meets girl. Girl loses girl. There's not much else going on here for 3 hours. In under 3 hours, Shakespeare did much better with the vagaries of adolescent love, taking them less seriously and for what they are, but foregrounding them against larger societal themes of war and peace. Does sexual orientation on its own, in the 21st century, make for a story? Pedophilia, sexual predation, and wounding class divisions, in Keshish's film, are stumbled up against, then retreated from, dodgily, glancingly, not really even gazingly. The portrait Keshish offers of France, mostly the city of Lille, is unceasingly pretty, demographically diverse, and replete with delicious cigarette smoking. He is not seeking quarrels. He wants things to be as attractive as they can be, all things considered, and sidles up to sentimentality. But his lead actress has run away with the film in a complicated way. 1970s film theory, Laura Mulvey, John Berger, and others, sometimes had it that the male gaze is directed at a woman, and the female gaze is directed at the male gazing at the woman. Hitchcock's Vertigo builds up its entire plot on this dialectic between viewer and viewed. Yet from the current vantage point in this somewhat antique model, the female gaze may consist of a composite vision and be more complex and authoritative by virtue of containing additional information. Then again, of course, the male gaze may be watching the female gaze as well, which adds an additional layer of power and perception, becoming a tertiary gaze, and then the female may gaze back, ad nauseam, in the nature of a hand-slapping game, or the infinite regression of a Quaker Oats box, or the badinage of Abbott and Costello. Such theory, often written in a prose with the forensic caress of an appliance warranty, may not be a useful way to look at films, especially when one is dealing with the high caliber of acting, visceral, rangy, possessed, that is on display in Keshish's film. The sex scenes notwithstanding, almost every moment contains a dramatic presence where interiority is brought forth via concentration, utterance, silences. This deserves a separate sort of notice. The close-ups of the young, still-forming face of Exarchopoulos shows that the director knew precisely what he had when he cast her. The camera work shows Exarchopoulos knowing what she's doing as well, etc. ad infinitum. An esteemed British actress was once asked why, in such a small country as England, there were so many great actors. "It's because we're always acting," she said. This past year has brought forth astonishing performances from young French-speaking actresses, not just Seydoux and Exarchopoulos, but Émilie Dequesne in the harrowing Belgian-French film Our Children. Have young francophone women newly seized a form of cultural expression for themselves? Have they kept their chic, insouciantly coiled scarves but broken free from something more oppressive? Or are they simply, and not so simply, always acting? 2013. Bernard Melamed. Note, a memorial tribute delivered at the Penn Melamed Memorial Reading, December 5, 2014. The autocorrect on my computer always wants to turn Melamed into Malamute, which may be apt, since a Malamute is strong, beautiful, carries heavy freight, and according to Wikipedia, also has a plush underbelly. Something similar perhaps can be said for Melamed's stories, their seriousness and yet their gentleness, but I won't spend too much time worrying this accidental metaphor. The brilliant stories of the Magic Barrel are largely about faith, love, work, and their various entanglements. The collection's characters are scholars, cobblers, egg handlers, tailors, census takers, doubt-ridden rabbis, floor walkers at Macy's. Their occupations are identified early, so we know that the story will be somewhat about work and its perils, especially as it intersects with love and spiritual resilience. The narrative voices are of their time and place, yet original and unprecedented in American letters. The stories are told with the sideways moves of self-interruption, of overlapping thoughts, of long fluid conversational syntax that suddenly dives inward for free indirect discourse. Melamed's narrative voice makes one grateful for the limberness of English and the history of America as a country of immigrants. The inverted syntax of Yiddish meets the English language, and the syntax winds into little eddies and reversals. It is how I myself often speak. For what I should change, even though I was raised a Baptist, this comes from the passage of time, from reading, from travel, from friends, from confusion. It also makes one grateful for Melamed's nimble use of all this, and despite the flourishes of voice, his stories are compressed and move along with great speed to surprising places. Repeatedly, in The Magic Barrel, a man is led out of his comfort zone to encounter an unexpected solace elsewhere. The reader takes these sometimes breathless journeys with him. Perhaps my favorite of these is a story titled Angel Levine. It is a story of disbelief, dancing, and patched-together faith. The world is full of Jews, it cries joyfully in the end, meaning that Earth is flecked with unexpected kith and kin and mercy, and one may not always recognize such in their various incarnations. Leaping past preconceptions leads to blessedness, or something like it. The disguises of God. This is what Melamed wrote of best. 2014. Miranda July. I first met Miranda July years ago at a faraway literary conference in Portland, Oregon. Along with Rick Moody and others, we were on a panel that was supposed to converse authoritatively about narrative structure. When it came time for July to speak, she stood up and started singing. She was large-eyed and lithe. I don't remember what song it was, something she had written herself, I believe. I was startled. Who was this woman? Her performances in short films had not appeared widely enough to have caught my notice. I was then mortified, not for her, since she seemed completely at ease and the audience was enthralled, but mortified for narrative structure, which had clearly been given the bum's rush. Well, fiction writers will do anything to avoid this topic. It is the one about which they are most clueless and worried and improvisational. Sitting next to July was the brilliant Dennis Johnson, who, inspired by his neighbor, when it was his turn, figuring out whose turn it is can be the most difficult part of a panel, also began to sing, also something he had written himself. I may have laughed, thinking it was all supposed to be funny, realizing too late my mistake. There was a tragic aspect to one verse in the Johnson song. I believe he did not sit down because he had not stood to begin with. Then it was clearly, or unclearly, my turn. If not the wallflower at the orgy, then I was the mute at the a cappella operetta, a condition typical of many a July character, though not of July herself. I refused to sing. I don't remember what I said. I believe I read from some notes, silently vowing never to be on another panel. The next panel I was on in Boston, I thought went well by comparison, that is, no one burst into random song. But when I said as much to the person sitting next to me, the editor of a prominent literary journal, he said, "Really? This was the worst panel I've ever participated in." So my introduction to July was one at which I watched her redefine boundaries and hijack something destined to be inert and turn it into something uncomfortably alive, whether you wanted her to or not. This has been my experience of her work ever since. July's first feature-length film, the now-famous independent Me and You and Everyone We Know, also upends expectations. July writes, directs, and stars in all her films. In many ways, while remaining a love story, the film is about the boundary-busting that is ruleless sexuality, stalking, and sexual transgression, though here the predators and perpetrators are gentle and female. A boy is coercively fellated by two slightly unpleasant teenage girls devising a competition. Low-level sexual harassment is everywhere, and July sometimes plays it for laughs. Two kids in a chat room lead someone on a wild goose chase, writing scatological comments in the language of very young children, and despite all this, it is hilarious. A shoe salesman named Richard, who has set his hand on fire in front of his sons, is hounded by a woman named Christine, played by July herself, who does not know him but who is erotically obsessed with him. She has psychically, and perhaps correctly, marked him as her mate. The telepathic heart is at the center of much of July's work. Another character, a middle-aged woman seeking a partner online, finds herself hooked up with a 5-year-old boy in the park. Images of flame and precariousness recur. The burning sun, the burning hand, a bright goldfish riding in a plastic bag on a car roof. And yet, all is put forward with tenderness and humor. The desire for human love goes unquestioned, and its role in individual fate is assumed to be essential. July's Christine, a struggling artist who works as a driver for Elder Cab, possesses a thin-skinned empathy for everyone, and her love for the shoe salesman, who is played in convincingly addled fashion by John Hawkes, is performed with both vulnerability and purity of passion. In her two feature-length films, the chemistry with her male lead is quite strong. They, as well as July, are like openly soulful children, attaching without reason or guile, and July is quite focused on this quality of connective vulnerability, as well as on children themselves. Her work also engages with the criterion offered up by the character of a museum curator looking at Christine's own works. Could this have been made in any era or only now? With July, it is a little of both. She focuses on people living courageously with grace, while also quietly arguing with a culture that asks us to do that. July's second film, the underrated The Future, continues her exploration of the dissolution of lines between self and other, life and death, animal and human. When one brings up one's admiration of this film to others, one is often greeted with the dismayed and dismaying, "Oh, not the one with the talking cat." It's indeed narrated by a deceased cat, voiceover by July. Even if this is initially strange, the cat speaking from its own afterlife about how one must sometimes wait forever and on into death for one's real life to begin, which is the life with love in it, at the end, it is quite beautiful, as is the film, which was based on a performance piece July first did at The Kitchen in New York. Both that piece and the film feature, not just the talking cat named Pawpaw, but a dancing shirt as well. The future tells the story of Sophie and Jason, a young couple in Los Angeles who are stalled in their lives and can neither move successfully forward nor out. Everyone else seems to have gotten the hang of it, marriage, responsibility, children, and Sophie, played by July, sees her friends and acquaintances in a kind of time-lapse photography, moving ahead without her on into grandchildren. When to disrupt her inertia, Sophie, a struggling dancer, leaves Jason for an inappropriate older man, someone with a job, a house, and a daughter. The longing both Sophie and Jason still have for each other, the closeness of their ties, the tender habits of their connection, become a kind of telepathy. And time is literally frozen by Jason to keep Sophie from saying the unsayable breakup words. One of July's recent projects has involved an app she created that allows other people to say unpleasant things on your behalf, such as, "I think we should see other people." July's love interest here is played by Hamish Linklater, who has a placid, natural vibe with his co-star. They have this sleepy reticence of people who have known each other their whole lives, and yet there is something tentative and sexy between them. July even filmed a graphic sex scene with Linklater that she decided not to include in the film since she felt it got carried away. "Everyone should film a raunchy sex scene for their movie, then delete it," she says in the DVD commentary. But the childlike innocence of these young people causes them to be unable to imagine any future world at all. Jason thinks that even his door-to-door canvassing for environmental causes is all for naught, all too late, that climate change has passed its tipping point, and the world is already, for all intents and purposes, over and unsalvageable. The film may end with an ocean scene, a talking moon, a pontificating cat, the inevitable reunion of the lovers, but it is profoundly stirring nonetheless. Like much of July's work, it is about the nature of time, which, finally, sadly, is no one's friend, nor does it provide enough of itself. So terrible and cruel, and its portion so small, as the old joke goes. July's first book of literary fiction, the 2007 story collection, No One Belongs Here More Than You, was a rare short fiction hit. For those who bought it for its bright yellow cover and bold sans-serif font in order to face the jacket outward in the guest room bookcase or the study where it can be made into a warm and welcoming objet, it may come as a surprise to learn that the volume contains at least two brilliant stories, especially the longest one, Something That Needs Nothing, which first appeared in The New Yorker. It is about two young women, an unnamed narrator and her friend Pip, who begin their runaway lives by scamming and sexually servicing older women. "We were targeting wealthy women who loved women. Did such a thing exist? We would also accept a woman of average means who had saved up her money." Boundaries are shattered. Politesse is thrown out the window. Purity of passion ensures not a thing. The narrator tries to keep Pip's interest by wearing a wig. When, overheated and delirious, she removes it, she is left utterly alone. What a woman will do for love is once again on the author's mind. How is this twee, fey, winsome? The words that are sometimes hurled at July and her work. Wes Anderson is occasionally labeled thus, but when one Googles Wes Anderson and fey, one gets a lot of pictures of him and Tina Fey. David Sedaris on the New Yorker Fiction Podcast interviewed about July's Roy Spivey, a story about the mutual psychological deformities brought about by encounters with celebrity, was asked how he felt about July's harsher critics. He confessed bafflement. "They're just jealous," he said, and one is inclined to agree. A young art student I spoke with recently said, "Miranda July is between generations. The older generation thinks she belongs to young people, but we don't think about her much. She seems middle-aged. The things we're doing now she did first, but most of us don't appreciate that." That too sounds plausible. Which brings us to her latest event, a somewhat bonkers debut novel entitled The First Bad Man. The narrator is a sensitive single woman named Cheryl Glickman, neither young nor old, neither here nor there. She seems quite buffeted by the random events of life, and when she allows her employer's 20-year-old daughter, Clee, to come live with her, she is quite literally buffeted.